I'm Sonia Morton Firth, and you're tuned in to the Sonia Morton Firth Show. If you're enjoying these interviews, then hit subscribe below. Thank you. Today, my guest is Nathan Jones. Nathan has spent his career serving in the Royal Air Force. Whilst on a mission flying in troops to Afghanistan, his plane took a nosedive. Nathan survived, but broke his back in the process. Watch this interview to learn the methods Nathan uses to turn trauma into growth. Nathan, thank you so much for being a guest on my show today. It's lovely having you sitting here in my kitchen.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's been great.
Great. Nathan, tell me a little bit more about your journey. You serve in the Royal Air Force.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about what you've been through.
So I joined the Air Force in 2005 and joined straight after university.
Well, what made you join? Was it a family?
My grandfather was a navigator on Lancasters in World War II.
Wow.
So he died before I was born. So it's that kind of nostalgic thing, I suppose, yeah. Going through, trying to emulate what he did. You know, flying in the Battle of Britain and everything else is pretty amazing stuff. My dad actually wanted to join the Air Force as a pilot, but was colourblind and didn't want to be a navigator. He just wanted to be a pilot. And then I think he sort of pushed me into it. So then he's lived vicariously through what I've been doing. Yeah. So it's been, I started flying when I was at university. And then I did the rest of my flying training afterwards when I'd actually gone through officer training.
And how many times have you actually served in battle?
I've been fortunate or misfortunate enough to have served in, pretty much all of the conflicts from when I joined up until now. Just because of the nature of what I've been doing, what I've been flying. So I've done the previous telex of Iraq stuff, Afghanistan, Libya, Syria, new Iraq stuff that's been going on with Daesh and ISIS. Been pretty busy.
And you're sitting here today and you must have seen some real atrocities. If I can take you back to some of the more challenging moments in your career, because you're still flying today.
No, I'm not flying
now. You're not flying.
No. So I'm injured after an incident that I had. In 2014, I was flying a troop transport aircraft, so it's called a Voyager. Mm. It's a military adapted Airbus A330, so you'll have flown on one, I'm sure. And we were flying troops into Camp Bastion in Afghanistan. An incident happened. I broke my back. And then...
What happened? Can you go into the incident?
Yeah. So we were flying along from Bryce Norton in the Cotswolds up to Camp Bastion, flying through the night. And I went for a break in the sort of middle of the flight. It's about an 8.5 hour flight. And when I was in the front galley, myself, along with everyone else that wasn't strapped in, suddenly hit the roof. I then had to crawl on the roof, back into the cockpit. Luckily the cockpit door was open. I crawled along the roof and then we...
And the pilots?
Two pilots. So I was the co-pilot at the time. I was a captain. That was still in the cockpit, and we managed to recover the plane and get it out of this dive. Unfortunately, in the process, I'd broken my back, which I subsequently found out. There was 198 people on board, so it was quite a day at the office.
It must have been. And what happened when you got through that? I mean.
So we diverted into an American Air Force base in Turkey called Incirlik Air Force Base. We were on the ground there for a week and then we had to be flown home. And it was an interesting one. Some people had to be bussed back because they wouldn't get back on a plane.
I'm not surprised.
Like Mr. T.
Did you know at that time, like Mr. T, yeah. Did you know at that time you broke me back?
No. No, I knew I'd done some damage, but it was kind of that stiff upper lip, I'll be fine, I'll crack on. And then I went to the hospital out there in Turkey, and the Americans triaged me because, you know, diverting aircraft, they sort of triage any injured passengers. There's no Brits out there. They didn't scan me there. Then by the time I got home, I was kind of, I want to get back flying. I just had this mental block, not necessarily a block, but the this way of mind to say, if I don't get back on the horse now, I never will. Mm. After this traumatic incident, so I just thought, no, I'm going to get back flying. So I actually went straight down to the Falklands, like 4 weeks later,
with a broken back, not knowing you'd broken.
Not knowing I'd broken my back. No. So I was just sort of cracking on regardless, taking loads of painkillers, thinking, it's all right.
You can just get through this with a few more drugs. You'll be fine.
Exactly. And then it, you know, manifested in itself, got worse and worse, and then. Yeah, turned out I broke my back. So now, you know, three surgeries later and a titanium cage and in my back, and it's all been cemented and nerves sorted. And yeah, so I sort of bleep going through all the airports now.
But it means you can't fly again.
So I have got back flying. So it's been a long peaks and troughs recovery through it. So 6 years ago, so it happened in February 2014. Mm. And then I got back flying in 2016, I think it was, and I flew again for 2 years. And then my back just got worse and worse and worse, and that's when I got fused. So that was the third and hopefully final surgery on it.
How has that affected you, not being able to fly and not being able to be out there again?
Do you know, I mean, there's pros and cons to what has happened, and you know, I'll go into it a bit about how I've dealt with it. It's when you first lose something like that, you know, it's been your life. Yeah,
right?
Well, that's it. It's your whole professional life.
Yeah.
It's a very tight knit group of people when you're on a squadron, and it's all your squadron mates, the guys who you've been through flying training with, and you go out on operations with them, and you share a lot of memories, and you're a pretty tight knit group. And then clearly they're still your friends, but when you're taken away from that and you're not doing it anymore, it's a real you feel that loss of camaraderie. Mm. And team ethos, and it's all the stuff that you hear all the time from veterans, I'm sure, and not that I'm a veteran, I'm still serving, but it's that kind of loss of identity, because you say, oh yes, I'm an Air Force pilot, what do you fly? Well, I fly a desk, I don't do anything now. So then it's kind of, alright, okay, fine.
Do you have to find a new identity? Is it almost finding yourself?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, and it's been hard. You know, that sort of transition through. I mean, you know, all of my rehab and recovery has been gearing back to go back to flying, and it's just, you know, it's become more and more unlikely to get back flying. But I'm still plugging away at it and still doing everything I can in that rehab space to hopefully get back flying in some capacity. I don't know what it'll look like, but I would love to be back in the air someday. For that, I knew that it was going to be a long road. So I had to kind of reinvent myself, reinvent my wheel to remold what I was. And, you know, I was lucky enough when I was on one of my rehab courses that one of my doctors was the team doctor for the British team in Invictus, for the Invictus Games.
Okay.
So I mean, the inaugural Invictus Games in London, I wasn't even injured for. I watched it on TV in Afghanistan. And then for the second one, I was then turned out. I was eligible for it as an injured guy. I was thinking. So it was kind of halfway through all of their training camps, and the doctor said, "Well, you know, you would be eligible for it. Why don't you go for it?" And it was the games in Orlando in 2016. Yeah, I went for it, got in, and then so went to Orlando. So it was lovely. Yeah.
Wow. And what did you do? What were you?
So I was cycling and swimming.
Cycling and swimming.
Yeah. And cycling first. I was really, you know, felt good about it. And in the road race, I was, you know, in that front pack until right at the end, kicked the line, went into first place, and the last corner got it wrong, smashed straight into a fence.
Oh, God.
And I cartwheeled down the road, went to hospital on a spinal board.
Oh, no.
Yeah, and I had a $98,000 medical bill after it. I didn't re-break anything or anything. It was just sort of soft tissue. Soft tissue pride damage. But yeah, it was an interesting one.
How did it make you actually feel doing that again?
It was an amazing experience. The whole thing is being back in a team again.
Yeah.
It's operating at a high level. You know, everything was looked after you with the international coaches, and there you were serving your country again. So it was an amazing thing. I managed to get back in the pool afterwards and swam, which was fine. And then the year later, I then did the Invictus Games again and went to Toronto.
Wow, and again, you were like,
I was all right then. Yeah, that was fine. So
I mean, has this given you a sort of a new lease of life?
Well, so off the back of that, so I then got back flying, and I was flying for the Toronto Games, and I was actually going to fly the team to the Games in Toronto and then compete, and something happened. I can't remember what it was, tasking levels, but. I just competed. So it was an interesting one, being an injured guy, but then I was kind of still serving, so not a veteran and back at work. So I was actually operating on quite a high level. And then it was just, sort of tailed off that. Then I had my next operation. And in my recovery after that next operation, I then managed to be seconded over to the Royal Foundation. So for the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge and Duke and Duchess of Sussex. So then I was there for a couple of years.
And I mean, in all of this rehabilitation, you've talked about physical things that you've been through with your back. What about the mental side? Was there any rehabilitation or any help mentally? I mean, you must have been going through some mental trauma.
Well, I was. I mean, straight after it, it was, as I alluded to before, it's kind of that stiff upper lip. No, I'm fine. Mm. So you go through a thing called TRIM training. It's the trauma risk incident management, I think it is. And, you know, people come over and in a very basic form, it's how are you feeling? Are you okay? And just check if you're all right. And then you go through a series of interviews over the next few weeks and then just get signed off. It's either you're suffering or you're okay. And I remember doing all those interviews and I was just, you know, just blanking everything out. I'm fine. So they just signed me off.
So they signed you off just because you said I'm fine.
And then I didn't necessarily know there was anything wrong. So, you know, I felt good. I could suppress any images and thoughts and emotions, and I found myself, you know, operating okay, but I knew deep down there was something wrong. There was some issues, and
what did it feel like when you had that deep down feeling?
It was a funny one. The thing is, it was other people telling me really, and saying, "Are you okay?" And I'd just sort of brush it off and go, "Yeah, I'm fine." Okay, well, you're not acting necessarily normal. You're acting kind of out of turn. And I was, you know, losing my temper and becoming quite agitated and, you know, all the sort of classic signs. And it took 5 years for me to then actually seek help.
Wow. So in those 5 years, what got you to the point to actually realising that you needed help?
Yeah, it was gradually manifesting itself over those 5 years from me being, I would say, mentally pretty strong. At the time of the incident, I was, you know, physically and mentally very fit. And then, so I suppose when you're in that peak fitness, then you can, it's, you know, it's the whole adage of your bucket is, you've only got so much before it fills and overflows.
And overflows, yeah.
So that was kind of, must have been semi the tipping point, and it may have needed a few other little bits to then tip it over. And I didn't have this one day I found myself in the corner shaking, but it was just gradually nibbling away. And then, yeah, other people just really calling me out on it, and my wife then saying, in a semi-intervention, I think you should go and seek help. So I did, and that was it. And I just went to the doctor, and then I was referred and diagnosed with PTSD.
Was there any point before that you felt like you couldn't admit to it, or that you felt any part of, well, I'm mentally fit, you know, I've been doing this all my life, I'm a man, or whatever you go through? Was there any part of you that didn't want to admit?
I mean, of course, yeah. It's that, you know, you never want to admit defeat, or never want to admit that you've got chinks in your armour. And, you know, this is why now there's so much emphasis on, it's, you know, it's good to talk. It's good to,
absolutely.
You know, it's not feeling that you're weak by owning up to having these issues. You know, it's being strong and not silent. So yes, in hindsight, I was a bit naive, but like many, you know, that sort of military alpha male mentality of keep calm and carry on.
Keep calm and carry on. So what happened after that? You were diagnosed with post-traumatic.
So I was diagnosed, and then that was it. Yeah, going through the.
And how have you got over that? What things have you pulled on?
Well, I mean, I'm still going through it now, so I'm still in my journey, in my recovery journey. So yeah, you do different psychological treatments. So the military mental health facility it's called DCMH, the Defence Centre for Mental Health, and then you're under their care, and they will do whatever treatment it is that's needed for you. So yeah.
Now it's been re-termed almost post-traumatic growth, or you can actually grow from this. How have you felt you've grown?
I think, you know, anyone who suffers a trauma will go through that trough, and then that is your post-trauma, where you're going to go through the doldrums, whether it's physical or mental injury. And then it's all about repurposing yourself and seeing how you're going to thrive from it. You know, and 9 times out of 10, you're going to have to do something different. You can't just carry on with what you were originally doing. And the studies, small studies been done, and there's more and more coming out on it about this post-traumatic growth phenomenon, really, especially from people who are in the military or ex-military that have suffered extreme trauma. Whether it's loss of limbs or loss of colleagues in front of them, or whatever it is, you know, there's a plethora of different reasons why you would suffer from it. And, you know, harping back to Invictus, that is kind of the cadre of people who have been through this Invictus journey to then come out and actually thrive from it. But you know, you've got guys like Dave Henson, who lost both of his legs, then a bronze medalist in the Paralympics in Rio, and he's now a doctor. So you know, if you know, you chat to Dave, he wouldn't have said beforehand.
Yeah, if I'd lost my legs.
And it's you know, you wouldn't wish that on anyone, but would you have achieved that level of growth, that level of performance, if the trauma hadn't happened to you, and it hadn't kind of given you that impetus to then feel like you had to strive? You know, you've got people like David Wiseman, who I've already spoken about, who, you know, is doing some amazing things, and he's there now working for the Invictus Games after he was captain. You've got JJ Chalmers, who is now on the full BBC Sports presenting desk after competing at Invictus. And you've got loads of Paralympians and people that are rowing the Atlantic, like Lee Spencer. Some amazing stories.
Do you think it's reaching that rock bottom? You almost have to reach that rock bottom to be able to go up. It's only at that point of real adversity that you can make the turning point. And not everyone makes the turning point. Obviously, there's two ways of going.
Yeah.
You know, and on the other side, on the flip side, there are people that don't pull themselves out of it, and unfortunately,
anything can happen
at that stage. But do you think there's something about being in the military? Because there's all sorts of people that can go through trauma. It's not just trauma from the military. But do you think having that mindset of serving, or you know, putting your life on the line for our country, do you think there's something in that that can help you, that brings you out of that? Words in your mind.
Well, I think there's probably it's a double answer to that statement. So yes, people in the military that have had this trauma happen to them, and then they've come out the other side, and then they've experienced this growth. You know, that's something that we can document and say, well, these people were of this personality type beforehand, so they were you know, strong in character. They thrived on being physically and mentally fit and being high performers. They could then get to that high performance afterwards, compared to a civilian who was knocked down off their bike by a bus and then had to then recover afterwards. So one, you would have thought that it would then be easier for those people to get back to or thrive even more. You can then say, you can use this military cadre who have experienced this post-traumatic growth to assist the people that are going through this trauma after something's happened to them, to then use them as the role models to then hopefully thrive and experience that post-traumatic growth. Because, you know, if they can do it, why can't the other people say?
It's a mindset, really, isn't it?
So it is all about mindset. Because it doesn't matter about, you know, if your physical injury means that you can't do the thing that you then want to go. Say you want to be an Olympian or Paralympian after it, but your body's not letting you do it, then go off and do something else. You know, there's always something there that you can then go into.
Completely.
Like Dr. Dave,
absolutely. And how are you getting through it? I mean, you said you're not through it yet. Are there things that you do on a sort of a daily basis to help you? If there's anyone out there that's listening that's maybe going through some trauma, maybe they're a veteran that's listening to this.
Yeah.
Is there anything, any sort of advice that you would give that's helped you?
So I'm kind of one of life's searchers. So I will always, you know, look at what the gurus are doing, what I'll be looking at the gadgets and what's helping you
the gadgets,
sleep,
so that's in, okay,
and what,
okay.
You know, the for me especially, I use one of these acupuncture mats that I lie out lie on, and it's like lying on a bed of nails.
I've nearly lied on one of those before, yeah.
I mean, they're you look like Hellraiser when you've got off it. But yeah, I find that really works. Over my, you know, this journey, you know, post-traumatic incident, I've really looked into all of this stuff and researched into it and what can make me a better person and the best that I can possibly be. And with that, I've found things that don't work and things that do work. And that's me personally. And I'll always give people advice on it and what's worked for me and what necessarily hasn't worked for me. And I've created my toolkit. And, you know, now there's a lot of stuff going on about these toolkits, these mental and physical toolkits.
What's in your toolkit? Can you give it a few
things? So, yoga.
Yeah.
I wish I had discovered yoga, you know, in my early teens.
But if you were probably told that back then in your teens, you probably would have said, no way am I doing that for women, or it's not
too fancy.
Yeah, hippie, yeah.
So yeah, yoga now, I have to do yoga every day. Even if it's just 5 minutes of a quick vinyasa flow, then I have to do that. Just to kind of focus my mind, but also just to keep my back mobile. Otherwise, I just, it's sort of rock solid. I've recently been getting into cold water therapy.
Are you doing Wim Hof? Have you heard of Wim Hof?
So I've got into Wim Hof as well, and the breathing techniques. So I've practiced loads of different breathing techniques. Wim Hof is very powerful. It's really good. I mean, Wim Hof is a crazy cat, but so if you can stomach watching him all the time, then great. But what he's talking about, I think, is really powerful. But you know, there are loads of different breathing techniques. I just think breath work in itself is really, really powerful, not only physiologically but psychologically as well, to just sort of push you through. So you're not necessarily getting that, you call it the end of the pool scenario, where if you're swimming underwater and you look up and see the end of the pool, you'll suddenly start panicking and you have to swim a bit quicker. Whereas if you just keep your eyes closed or look at the bottom of the pool, you just be able to swim and swim and swim and then suddenly bump your head. But yeah, so breathing, definitely I have to do that. And then that goes hand in hand with this cold water therapy and then tapping into that parasympathetic nervous system. So I mean, you know, I've got a wheelie bin full of cold water in my back garden.
Oh my gosh, you don't get into your wheelie bin. Wheelie bin.
And the fact that I've got this social distancing beard, I just look like...
that's why I didn't recognise you.
I look like one of the Sesame Street, the guy that lives in the bin. So, but it's so powerful.
Works.
Yeah, I mean, I do it in the morning if I can. I'll do it once a day. I find it really powerful in the morning because it then sets you up for your day. Do it, you know, as soon as you get up. And I do it for probably 20 minutes. And then I can either just do a meditation when I'm in there, or I'll listen to a guided meditation.
You actually meditate in...
when I'm in the bin.
In the ice bin.
In the ice bin.
Wow.
But, you know, doing that, because you're controlling your breath.
Yeah.
And, you know, yeah, it's pretty chilly when you first get in it, but it's amazing how quickly you can then become acclimatized to it. Try it. Get a bin. Give yours
one
a clean.
Of these, right? Yes, yeah. Definitely.
And then, or do it at night. You know, do it sitting in cold water when you're beneath the stars.
I've been trying the cold showers.
It's amazing. So cold showers exactly. Yeah. That's the first step.
Yeah, the first step. Yeah.
And exactly, just how Wim Hof describes it in his guided courses, where it's, you know, it's first the breath, and then leading into 30-second cold shower, 10-second cold shower, and then building up. But that is it. It doesn't matter where you are, but if you're getting into that cold water, you might be able to have a cold bath. You don't need a wheelie bin full of water. You might be able to, you might have a stream outside. You might have a lake or the sea, and you can go in and just experience that. And people will be able to get different benefits from it. even if it's just going in and feeling alive, you know, that's amazing. What else do I do? I've had issues with sleep. So previous to my injury, I used to monitor my sleep for sport reasons. But then after this, now I really do have to monitor my sleep, and then it's all about my schedule before I go to bed, and then how I wake up.
What helps you go to sleep? What is your schedule? Just roughly, is there anything that you?
I used to be terrible at just, you know, watching box sets or whatever, just, you know, you're kind of like falling asleep on the sofa, and then it's like, right, I go to bed, and then you're awake when you're in bed and you're tossing and turning. So I have to kind of go zero blue light for at least half an hour beforehand. I'll have a cutoff time and then just go, right, okay, hold on, I'll just read a book now, and then get into that zone down state. Nice. So then I can then, if I want to do some stretches, do some yoga, do some mindfulness stuff, then I can wind down. Otherwise, I am just alert, lying in bed thinking, God, I'm awake now. And then at the same time, the other side is, you know, it's so easy. There's so many sleep apps out there, all these Lumi lights that can gradually wake you up rather than just pinging you up out of the wrong points in your circadian rhythm. You know, if your alarm goes off and you're in that
and you're in your rhythm, absolutely.
Yeah, you wake up groggy and you're stuffed for the rest of the day. So, I think that's the sleep aspect is incredibly powerful. So it is it's well and truly in my toolkit. Okay. Yeah.
Do you think the military should start putting this into practice early on, almost as a prevention rather than a, you know, now you've had the trauma, here you go. These are some of the things that you could do to help.
So we are. So So one of my programs when I was at the Royal Foundation was a program called Head Fit. Mm. And it's all about positive mental fitness. With that, it's rather than reactive, it's preempting anything. So you look at it as more of a performance tool than a post-trauma or post-anything. Post issue. Right from day one of training, the guys and girls will get that, and it's, you know, it's a simple it's an app format website that you can just go on, and it's got all of the content that it was done through King's College London with their psychologist Vanessa Moulton, then created this toolkit really for everyone to follow. So it's just step-by-step stuff that you can just dip in and out of, but it's open source for tri-service, so everyone can go in. But it's headfit.org, and anyone can get on it,
and what else for Nate, because we've got to mention Declassified as well. You've got your own podcast.
Yeah.
Do you want to tell me a little bit more about that?
I mean, it's a bit of a grotesque plug now, but we started a
plug away.
Started a network. It's called the Declassified Network. We started it a couple of years ago. So it started out with a podcast, much as yourself sort of starting out, and it was about creating military stories from all of these amazing military stories, not just necessarily people that have been injured, but Military Cross winners, Distinguished Flying Cross winners, to all sorts of psychologists. That's then now developed. So there's three of us in it. So there's Michael Coates, Des Fraser, and I. Those boys are ex-military. I'm the ex-army. I'm still serving, obviously. What we're doing is we're trying to promote positive mental fitness. Mm. So much like we did with HeadFit, it's in this network of people that we can then use these role models that I've been discussing, and then hopefully inspire generations in the future. Right. And it's not necessarily people that have suffered from traumatic incidents. Everyone has suffered some sort of trauma in their life. Doesn't matter who you are.
Anyone. And probably right now people are suffering a lot more trauma with COVID.
Exactly. You Exactly. So yeah, it's giving them some of these tools that they can then, you know, hopefully make themselves better themselves for the future, and give themselves more clarity. Because if your mind's not right, then nothing's going to be right.
It's got to start with the mind.
Yeah.
And you've just been nominated for an award as well. Which
two awards. Two at the British Podcast Awards. So, yeah, that'll be amazing.
Fantastic.
I just hope that the award ceremony actually happens.
Let's hope it happens. No, that would be awful. It's not quite the same collecting your award.
I know, yeah.
Nathan, it's been amazing having you on my show today. And I feel very honoured from one podcaster to another. But I've come to my last question, which is, if you were to write a message in a bottle for future generations to find, what would that message be?
Right, okay. Probably. So for me, I would say, listening to people's advice is key, and I've always tried to listen to people's advice throughout my life. Doesn't matter what I've been doing, but you've got to sort of carve your own path, and create yourself, and don't be just a carbon copy of someone else or what someone else wants you to be. So it's take tidbits of everyone's advice, but then just carve your own path.
Carve your own. Nathan, thank you very much for being a guest on my show. It's been amazing having you here. Thank you.
Thanks for having me on. It's been great.
Am I allowed to give a hug or are you?
We'll do an air high five.
We'll do an air high five. Hope you enjoyed the show. Remember, there's a new interview out every Monday. So hit subscribe and like, and you'll get it straight into your inbox.